Local government rarely sets the pulse racing, but the services it provides, from emptying our bins to providing adult social care, not to mention local planning, are fundamental to our lives. The first storm warning of serious trouble in this normally placid world was 2 years ago when Thurrock Council in Essex faced a £500 million black hole in its finances. The assumption was that it was an outlier, the result of weak controls, poor council leadership and unwise investments that were particular to it. But since then, five other local authorities, including Nottingham, Birmingham and Croydon, have fallen like dominoes, declaring bankruptcy. One in five of England's 327 local authorities are now projected to be insolvent by next year. Something is clearly going very wrong. A lot's at stake. Speak to anyone working in frontline council services and they'll tell you that any further cuts will decimate how we look after society's most vulnerable. Professor Andy Pike, as Sir Henry Daish, Chair of Regional Development Studies at Newcastle University, has placed local authorities under his microscope, trying to figure out what caused the crisis and how to solve it. He's just written a book about it, Financialisation and Local Statecraft, and he joins us today from Newcastle. Andy Pike, great to have you with us. Thank you so much for giving up your time.
Thanks, Will. Yeah, delighted.
Now, when we asked you to be on the We Society podcast, there's a curiously titled podcast, what was your first thought?
Yeah, fantastic. I think the work that the Academy does and your role as well in terms of promoting the importance of social science in understanding the pressing issues of the day is really important. And as you say, the kind of arcane, boring world of local government has really been thrust onto the front pages now by these large-scale, high-profile so-called bankruptcies of situations where local governments have been unable to balance their books and provide for essential services in local communities. So a vital role you've got to play in publicising and raising the profile of these sorts of issues and debates.
Well, thanks. Let's plunge into this. I think our listeners should get some sense of scale. We're talking over 300 local governments in England, £100 billion of revenue, and employing 1.5 million people. I mean, this is big potatoes by any standards.
Big business indeed, yes. As a branch of the state, albeit a highly centralised one in the UK, local government is a vital part of our kind of democracy and institutional fabric at the local level. A connection in many ways between citizens and the state and the kind of at least residue of a social contract that we have in terms of what the state provides and what citizens are entitled to in as part of our kind of political economic settlement. But one that's been kind of hollowed out and undermined in many ways by long-term centralisation and a kind of heavy hand of particularly national and central government then in England in managing local government.
I'm going to get to that in a second, but every time there's a local government blows up, sometimes led by a Conservative council, sometimes led by a Labour council, the reaction of most commentators is not this is the consequence of some of the most extraordinary cuts in expenditure that any branch of government in any democracy has ever suffered, but rather to say, well, the casino councillors, they gambled taxpayers' money, futile property development, stupid schemes, weak controls, they deserve all that's coming to them. I mean, just give a sense of where you think the kind of burden of responsibility lies for this really quite dangerous crisis that's threatening to envelop us.
Certainly, the book was really motivated by trying to get beyond the headlines of these high-profile councils that were being sort of tarred with this narrative of councillors at the casino. The idea that our locally democratically elected leaders and executives then were gambling with local taxpayers and residents' money then on these kind of financially innovative schemes. But part of the story, as you indicate, Will, was really trying to respond in ways to the more than 30% reduction in their spending power since 2010 as part of austerity from the coalition government and being forced to both make drastic savings in terms of the services that they provide, but also to generate new sources of income.
I just think you should really pause there, actually, Andy.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah,
I think people should just take that in. The Local Government Association talk about a 27% cut in spending. You talk about 30. I mean, it's a big number. And I struggle to think of any period in British economic history where expenditure cuts of that type have actually kind of been entertained and stuck over time. And you have to go back to the 1920s and the Geddes Acts. You have to go back to the kinds of cuts that were proposed to keep the pound and the gold standard in 1930, 31, which prompted the collapse of the first general Labour government under Ramsay MacDonald. I mean, but even then, they didn't dare go for this kind of dramatic cuts over more than a decade. I do think that, you know, everyone should just take this in, that it's been quite extraordinary background to this podcast, is that, and it should be foregrounded and discussed. I mean, why was it ever allowed to happen that local government had this kind of severity of austerity imposed on it?
I think you have to go back, really, I suppose, to the sort of constitutional position of where local government sits within this highly centralised UK state, and in particular the degree of high centralisation within England itself that really places national government in the driving seat. Local government then is a creature of Parliament, and the idea that you can make savings at a time of austerity can be kind of rolled out, if you like, to those lesser branches of government. And it had a very willing Secretary of State at the time, Right Honourable Eric Pickles, that was first to volunteer swinging levels of cuts as part of this contribution to what was, let's not forget, framed as a national fiscal emergency in the post-2008 crash period.
Of course, what you say is true. I mean, it is, and I've when I've written about it, I've been very struck, you know, that, and people, again, it sounds kind of fanciful, but in this respect, the British Constitution is not greatly dissimilar to the one that was invented after the Norman Conquest of 1066. I mean, William the Conqueror invades, and England is a conquered power, and actually, all power is held by, you know, the centre, and he's sovereign over all he surveys. He does the Doomsday Book, and actually the relationship between kind of the locality and the centre in Westminster and Whitehall was firmly established then, and it's always been the doctrine in Britain, in England in particular, ever since, that sovereignty can only be lent to the locality by a beneficent king in Parliament, or monarch in Parliament. But at no stage since the kind of 11th and 12th centuries has any kind of central government imposed this degree of austerity on localities. I mean, it's an extraordinary... it didn't happen in the 19th century. In fact, in the late 19th century, great city leaders like Chamberlain in Birmingham had a great deal of freedom and were given it by central government. And it seems that actually in 2010, something very particular and special happened.
Yeah, certainly, as you indicate, the municipal heyday of local government very much in the 19th century with the whole range of essential services of gas, water, other utilities and so forth being provided by local government was that kind of heyday of local fiscal power and fiscal space to be able to raise revenues and deliver services and have that degree of local democratic control. But there's been a steady centralisation since that period. And I guess in a centralised state, when you're looking for savings, it's easier to sit in Whitehall and decide that a certain branch of government will be forced to kind of swallow those savings over a period of time than it is to, I guess, ask the local government to try and make the savings itself. But in many ways, the austerity was devolved in a sense that local government still had its statutory tasks to deliver adult and children's social care, for example, but was asked to do so using less money and through generating other alternative sources of income. So that was really the bind that local government was really forced into by, as you say, these unprecedented levels of expenditure reductions.
But that's not the currency. That's not the story that's told, is it? And maybe local government actually didn't help itself. Maybe it should have been more... less willing to try and make things work. Because, I mean, your book outlines the various stratagems that were adopted, and they were, in a sense, trying to kind of roll with the punch and keep the flag flying, even though they were faced with this extraordinary stringency in the amount of money that was being allocated to them. Perhaps they should have been more judicious and just said, look, you know, I'm sorry, central government, you know, if you want these kinds of cuts, it will devastate the services that we're providing, and that's... be all and end all. I mean, they did, but no one ever said that.
Yeah, it's a very good point, Will, you make. Local government officials and finance executives and leaders and so forth will always go back to this argument that in many ways they're their own worst enemy, because local government has proved incredibly adaptable and capable in just rolling with the punches then of this unprecedented austerity and just attempting to balance the books, as they have to do through legal requirement on an annual basis, and just get the services out there and at least cover their statutory responsibilities as local authorities. And I think you see that, as the book describes, over the decade, with initially a kind of hoarding of reserves because there was uncertainty about future financial settlements, cutting, if you like, those non-statutory, non-essential services, you know, and really kind of developing strategies that started to evolve as austerity deepened over the decade, then into having to make much more substantial reorganisations, having to draw upon reserves, having to be much more risky and speculative in terms of trying to generate new sources of income. So the sheer length of austerity over the decade, right up until the pandemic, where local government, of course, was a kind of first responder, really kind of deepened and sort of amplified the pressure on local governments to actually respond to these unprecedented cuts.
Were there differences in strategy between, you know, county councils, district councils, unitary authorities? I mean, there's various... There's a whole kind of archipelago of different structures in local government. I wondered to what extent you found those different strategies that were adopted. Were some kinds of local government more swashbuckling than others?
Yeah, certainly. The book kind of divides up the 327 and identifies three different kinds of behaviours, really. There's this clear vanguard, and these are the sort of high-profile local governments that were really kind of out there in terms of getting involved in new financial innovations like sale and leaseback schemes on local assets, on bond issues, on engaging in even in interest rate swaps more recently, which we hadn't seen since the days of Hammersmith and Fulham and the swaps debacle back in the 1990s. So that was a vanguard, but they were a relatively small group, but they made the headlines, and the story they created, the narrative that emerged from them, was the councillors at the casino story, which came to tar much of the other local governments involved. There was an intermediate group that were involved in something of these kinds of innovations, but they were relatively small parts of their overall financial strategies. And then there was a long tail of probably more than half of local governments that were not involved in any of these innovations at all. So what the book was really trying to do, and again, it's the power of social science in revealing that broader landscape and picture, is to really leaven the picture, to show much more about the breadth and depth of the complexity of what was going on amongst these different kinds of local governments, and the extent to which many of them weren't following these kind of speculative, high-risk kind of strategies, which were liable to fall over.
There doesn't really seem to be much difference between Labour administrations or hung administrations or Conservative administrations. I mean, you couldn't predict through the political complexion of a local authority which way it was going to jump.
Yeah, we found that in terms of cutting the data, as you mentioned before, there were about five different types of local government across England, but also crucially in terms of political leadership. You couldn't read off from political leadership which strategies were being followed. Yeah, from Conservative, Labour, Liberal Democrat, no overall control. You could find Conservative authorities that view private enterprise as not the business of local government and would not get involved in commercial or private sector schemes because they would see that as encroaching on the private market. You would see Labour authorities that, again, you would think would be about a big state and a more collective agenda, being much more involved in high-risk commercialisation and borrowing strategies, and all shades in between across the 327 local governments. So, yes, you couldn't read off politically in terms of what was going on and what strategies were being pursued.
Now, one of the points you make is you talk about local statecraft, that actually there is statecraft at local level, and we talked about the austerity. There's a third kind of component in your thinking, which is that all this kind of interacted with an increasingly sophisticated financial system, or tricksy financial system, if you want to use a more pejorative term, that was actually very keen on providing a kind of suite of financial options to local government, from which you could pick and choose to do financial engineering that would to take some of the pressure off its budgets. I mean, without that, a kind of more staid, more regulated financial system, as we had in the 50s and 60s and 70s, would not have opened the door to this kind of extraordinary kind of cornucopia of financial schemes.
Certainly, yeah. The book was very exercised by the extent to which this process of financialization was starting to intermingle and connect with the world of local government in a much more pronounced way. And by financialization, I mean just the rise and power of financial institutions and the financial system and markets in the realm of local public services and their delivery. And certainly you had a curious story in the UK situation where the financial sector was really warded off, I think, local government as a potential market for their services from the Hammersmith and Fulham swaps debacle back in the 1990s, where a whole series of derivatives contracts that were entered into by the local government were actually rendered ultra vires. I think it was a House of Lords decision ultimately. So these contracts were voided and the banks took a big hit of 500 million odd quid at the time. And this sort of warded off the financial sector from dealing with local government. So you had a sort of stilling effect over a number of years, which, as you say, Will, has started to sort of change. And in particular, through the 2000s and kind of the other side of the crash, you really started to see financial actors then starting to see local government then as a big new market. And there's a chapter in the book that looks at all the sources of external advice of various kinds that have been getting involved in advising and selling services. And that's been crucial because without that, and don't forget the cuts have meant that the capacity of local government to kind of do the thinking for themselves and try and think of innovative ways to address savings and generate new sources of income then have relied upon them engaging with external advice then to try and help. And that might be the big consultancies, smaller freelance or small outfits, as well as treasury management advisors.
Just a quick break in the conversation to tell you about the Academy of Social Sciences, the organisation behind the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences, the national body for social science academics, practitioners and learned societies. From listening to the podcast, you'll hear that social scientists are at the forefront of tackling the most pressing issues of our time. And in this podcast, we bring you some of their best ideas to shape the way we live. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. Just to be clear to our listeners, I mean, what are the absolutely kind of inviolable statutory obligations of a local government? I mean, what does it have to do in any circumstance?
I mean, the key things, and these have been part of the issues with the financial crunch at the moment, is provision of adult social care, special educational needs, and the kind of housing and homelessness issues. Those are three of the big areas, really, that are absolutely fundamental and part of that statutory remit.
So, I mean, a local government is required by law to house all its citizens to ensure that there is sufficient capacity in its care homes to ensure that they all have care as they grow older, and that special needs kids in schools have the necessary kind of support for their circumstance. And those are the three things that local government must do over and above collecting bins and providing street lighting and all the rest.
Yeah, those are the fundamental things. And I think more importantly, conceiving of those as the fundamental services for people and often some of the most vulnerable people in society. So that really underlines local government's critical role in provision of these kinds of services to those people who are not always in circumstances that they can help themselves.
You know, when Chamberlain took over Birmingham as mayor in the 1870s, I mean, one of the things that he did was he really kind of revolutionised sanitation in Birmingham. I mean, it was building sewers, building clean water mains, and incurring the borrowing necessary to do that and charging the ratepayers the rates to make that happen. I mean, Chamberlain could not do that in Birmingham today, could he?
Well, certainly it's interesting. I mean, public health is another duty now that has found its way into the orbit of local government. And, you know, arguably one of the things is that local government has become so big, so complex, so difficult to kind of, I guess, manage and also audit as well. There's a whole story about how the audit market has been breaking down, that it's a big beast often locally to try and kind of orchestrate and manage in effective ways. And when you put that under pressure of making cuts and generating new income sources, it's a challenging task to deliver. I think the whole issue of the broader remit of those kind of infrastructural utilities that you're talking about there, Will, and the kind of heyday of Chamberlain's Birmingham and being able to kind of issue almost bond-like instruments to raise capital to invest in local infrastructures. Of course, in the UK, we've had a wholesale kind of privatisation of those kind of infrastructures, which have been removed not only from local government, but actually from the state and moved into the provision of private markets in many cases.
Is there an example of a local authority that's really done well, that really got it, that's sorted it, that you do, as an exemplar of what could be done? I mean, we mentioned ones in the introduction that are failing, but who's done well? Who's managed their way through this well?
Yeah, I think these are the local governments that have really kept under the radar, really. I think where the local government funding crisis has started to really pinch now is you're starting to see a widening group of so-called at-risk local governments. The Department of Levelling Up, Housing and Communities apparently has a watch list that it's working with closely a number of local governments which are seen as at risk of being unable to balance their budgets. And so there are a number of local authorities that are doing okay, that are managing to muddle through and balance the budget year to year, albeit sometimes with some strategies then that might end up being relatively short term. So using up reserves, selling off assets, these kind of things that are not repeatable strategies, arguably, over time to be able to cope with the fiscal crunch.
I mean, are the big mayoralities doing well? I mean, you know, Andrew Street in Birmingham, Andrew Burnham in Manchester, Sadiq Khan in London, are they doing well?
Yeah, I mean, the book didn't look at the combined authority level, so we were really only looking at the sort of lower and first upper tier of local governments. So we didn't explore the whole world of mayoral combined authorities and combined authorities. But clearly, another piece of work could be focused on that level. They have met relatively modest kind of legal obligations and financial resources relative to their constituent local governments. And I'm sure in the situation, for example, of Birmingham and being unable to balance its budget creates a headache then for the West Midlands Combined Authority, for example, when you've got a big dominant local government within a combined authority grouping then having such fundamental fiscal problems.
Solutions. I mean, what limits local government from working to its full potential?
Yeah, I think there's a range of things, and we sort of discuss in the book, taking a step back from the story since 2010 to try and think, I suppose, in terms of the big structural changes that you'd want, which really would be about perhaps moving in a more continental European direction to really embed and enshrine the sort of responsibilities and crucially the matching funding in some kind of settlement that would be much more embedded within how the state works. So changing local government from being this creature of parliament where the government of the day can decide how much it can raise council tax by without a referendum, all this kind of micromanagement type stuff from the national centre, and really giving much more of a right to self-government that would really enable funding to follow duties. It's a principle well established in other countries, enshrined within a constitution, so it's not changed by the government of the day with our 4 or 5 year political cycle. But of course, in the UK, lacking a written constitution and not much tradition of these kinds of ways of thinking, that seems a somewhat far-off hope. Then there's a whole range of, I guess, more intermediate sort of incremental types of changes which are well discussed within the sector. So the idea of actually reviewing once again the balance of funding then between national and local government. The whole question of fiscal devolution, of trying to give more tax raising powers then to local government, to give multi-year settlements to enable local governments to plan better rather than this sort of year-to-year patch and fix. And we've just seen another example of this now with the recent increased settlement then to local governments there in the most recent announcement, and even shifting the kind of basis of taxation, because local government relies upon two forms of property taxation, the domestic through the council tax, you know, which is still working on the valuation of properties from 1991, and then the business rates, the non-domestic property taxes too. So some kind of reform of these systems of taxation and revenue raising for local government would be key. So improving fiscal devolution, as it's called, the local tax raising, as well as watching for the equalisation, so that those with stronger tax bases then don't kind of race ahead with the revenue generating capacity relative to places with much weaker tax bases. So the equalisation mechanisms are fundamental in that.
It is. I mean, there's a whole suite of things there, isn't there? I mean, the idea that Britain in 2024, that people who occupy the house are still kind of paying council tax levied on its value in 1991 is completely incredible. I mean, it's the kind of thing which happens to failed states, or you might find in parts of Latin America or Africa where kind of machinery of government is utterly kind of broken down. But for such a situation to happen in a developed economy like Britain is amazing. And it's amazing that we don't have some kind of automatic system for revaluing property values, you know, residential property values. I mean, and it's also produces a very unfair system, so that, you know, people in the richer parts of the country, because their house is so kind of gone up so extravagantly compared to 1991, they're paying a fraction of what they might otherwise do. Whereas people in parts of the country where property prices have gone up less, it's unbelievably unfair and unbelievably irrational. And yet we can't talk about it.
Yeah, it is. It's a curiosity, a serious curiosity. I think politically...
And you're being kind. It's more than a curiosity, isn't it? It's outrageous.
It's outrageous. I mean, politically, you can understand it in the sense that... and again, it speaks to your point from earlier, Will, that local government and local government finance and funding, you know, is arcane, boring. People don't want to talk about it. But one thing they will get excited about is local taxation levels, and certainly council tax. And I think we've seen, and probably the poll tax didn't help with this in terms of that public protest and the government attempting to move and reform a system in a radical and very regressive manner, that this is a politically very hot, potentially toxic topic. And no government over the recent decades then, since 91, then have been willing to touch it. The possibility that everybody's council tax would be going up across the country then, you would see a government running a country mile from. But it's interesting to see now that various groups, I think Northern Powerhouse Partnership were the most recent one to call for a reform of council tax. But again, it's going to be a very, very low order issue for any incoming government now in this election year of 2024.
I mean, you simultaneously know that if, you know, Keir Starmer or Ed Davey dared to talk about revaluing residential property values from their 1991 values in the manifesto, they'd be murdered by our media and the Conservative Party. And they would do the same, actually, to the Conservative Party if it dared to raise its flag like this. So we're living in a country where the political system simply cannot deliver a rational base for property taxation. And it happens to be the case, there's a number of IMF studies which suggest that countries with fairer systems for property taxation have a bit less inequality and better economic performance than those that don't. So, I mean, we're in a bind here.
Yeah, I think, as you say, there's international studies that see that inequality is a drag, really, on growth. And, of course, the UK has been struggling with economic growth and has faced this kind of stagnation conundrum. How on earth do you get out of this? And these kind of reforms, you know, what on the one hand might seem as far-reaching, slightly one step removed or two steps removed from this central problem of how do you stimulate further growth and tax proceeds to redistribute or give away, I think that is an interesting way where the arguments perhaps could be reframed, that these sorts of reforms might be fundamental of part of the solution to some of these growth problems. And I think you're right in the sense that You spoke earlier about this geography of discontent and the idea of a frayed local state sort of feeding into this sort of populist, easy solutions for complex problems sort of politics. And I think that is part of it, that when people see that their local government is not able to provide the services that they feel they're paying for locally by council tax and business rates and so forth, then that does feed into this sort of gnawing distrust of politicians, of public institutions and their ability to make people's lives better through the provisions of these key services.
Well, drawing near the end of this, and I want you to say, just give our listeners some hope. I mean, give us the Andy Pike solution to all of this. So you have a week, and you are supreme leader of the UK and England in particular. What are you going to do to solve this?
I think what's important, there's no sort of silver bullet, I don't think, for this. Otherwise, people far more skilled and cleverer than me on local government finance issues would have already done this. But I think the important thing is we're getting to a point where there's a recognition that this is not just bad governance, poor decision making, you know, locally particular difficult situations that are all the fault of the local political leaders and officers. We're getting now, I think, to a system where there's a recognition of a dysfunctional set up for local government funding that needs to be addressed. And I think the fundamental thing to do is to move towards this new settlement for local government, to reform these national and local government relations so that funding follows duties and the legally required and statutory things that local governments are being tasked to do by national government then are given appropriate and matching funding. And I think that and the complexities that then will then trigger through that local government funding system, which is complex, Byzantine and often difficult for those involved in it to understand, those reforms can actually be put in place. And I think that might be one of the kind of key steps that you could take to move this all forward in lieu of that kind of bigger shift towards a basic sort of right for local self-government and a kind of written constitution that might codify and give that autonomy and proper funding and functions, if you like, to local government. But as I say, that's at least moving in the right direction to get this kind of new settlement for them.
Who's got this right? Who can we look to internationally and say, you know, that's the model to go with?
There's been some excellent work done by Andrew Walker and colleagues at the Local Government Information Unit looking comparatively at a range of local government funding systems in Germany and in France and Japan, I think is the most recent study they've done. And I think there isn't a wholesale model, I don't think, that you can take and import into these often very particular national structures. But there are certain key lessons about funding following duties, about preserving that legislative and constitutional autonomy for local government, of ensuring that there's a degree of support, if you like, within that funding system for local government to be able to decide what's important locally. Because don't forget, this is a local tier of government, not just a set of institutions that deliver public services. You know, and those that local determination of priorities and provision is really a fundamental thing that local government is meant to do, but of course very difficult to exercise in such a highly centralised system as we have in England.
Yes, earlier in my life I lived in Switzerland and for a couple of years, and I was very struck at how the community in which I lived had such power to not just tax, but also to, if there needed to be a kind of second football field or more tennis courts for the local tennis club, they could just kind of have a local referendum, decide it was what the people in the community wanted, and did it. And you know, it's kind of really, for an Englishman, it was incredible. You know, that could happen. I mean, coming from a country where such initiative would be vetoed from on high, and it's that kind of recognition that citizens need to have as much control over their lives as possible, and that's the route to a kind of a better life and a better society. You've been pointing the way to that, Professor Pike. Thank you so much for giving up your time to the We Society podcast. You've taken us on a remarkable kind of survey of the amazing diversity of ways in which local government's been responding to this imposed and crisis of austerity in which we've had these extraordinary kind of 30% cut and near 30% cut in its spending power over the last 10 years, and the ways in which it's trying to manage its way out of that. And now in 2024, at last, you know, it's come to a point where something has to give, and you've suggested what a better future might be. And I sincerely hope that in the years ahead, that a government of whatever hue heeds what you're arguing. I'm sure it's right. Thank you so much. That's all from us on the We Society for this week. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Will.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, who can be found at acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. Have any suggestions for guests, feedback for the programme? Email us on wesociety@acss.org.uk. And above all, thank you for listening.